A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. The UK non-dom regime. He wants us to walk through its origins, who used it, why it became politically untenable, and the recent reforms that abolished it. Also, the psychology of tax avoidance among people who already have more money than they could spend, the legal versus illegal distinction, and the broader offshore toolkit, trusts, shell companies, carried interest dodges. He mentions Akshatamurti. There's a lot to unpack here.
By the way, today's script is courtesy of DeepSeek V4 Pro, so whatever I say that sounds unusually coherent, credit the model.
I'll blame it for your tangents too.
So the non-dom regime. This is one of those things where the name sounds like a technical footnote, and it's actually this extraordinary 200-year-old loophole that shaped who paid for Britain and who didn't. The origins go back to 1799.
1799. That's William Pitt the Younger, right? Napoleonic Wars. Britain needs revenue.
Pitt introduces income tax as a temporary wartime measure, and he builds in this carve-out. If you're living in Britain but your permanent home, your domicile, is elsewhere, you only pay tax on money you bring into the country. Your foreign income and foreign gains stay outside the UK tax net. The logic at the time was, we want colonial administrators, merchants, people with overseas holdings to base themselves here without getting hammered on their global income.
Which made a certain sense when the empire was a thing and you had people shuffling between Calcutta and London.
And the key distinction, which a lot of coverage models, is domicile versus residence. Residence is where you live right now. Domicile is where you consider your permanent home, typically where your father was domiciled when you were born. You can live in London for 40 years and still claim your domicile is somewhere else, as long as you never intend to stay permanently.
The entire architecture rests on this almost metaphysical question of where your heart truly lies.
That's not even me being poetic. That's genuinely how the courts have framed it. There's case law about whether someone's animus manendi, their intention to remain, shifted. Judges have had to rule on whether a wealthy individual intended to return to some other country, possibly at death.
Who actually used this? I mean, the popular image is Russian oligarchs and Gulf sheikhs parking themselves in Kensington.
That's the post-Soviet wave, definitely. But the original user base was different. For much of the 19th and 20th centuries, it was aristocrats with Irish estates, colonial civil servants, Greek shipping magnates. The modern explosion happened in the 1990s and 2000s. London becomes this global hub for finance, property, private schools. If you're a billionaire from anywhere, you can park your family in London, buy a townhouse in Belgravia, send your kids to Eton, and pay remarkably little UK tax on your global wealth, as long as you structure things so that your foreign income never touches a UK bank account.
The numbers on this are significant.
HMRC data from a few years back showed about 75,000 people claiming non-dom status, though that number fluctuates. The politically explosive figure was always the long-term non-doms, people who'd been in the UK for more than 7 of the previous 9 tax years. At that point, you had to start paying an annual charge to maintain the status. It was £30,000, later bumped to £60,000 for people resident more than 12 years, but if your global tax bill would otherwise be in the millions, £60,000 is a rounding error.
It's basically a subscription fee for a tax discount.
That's exactly what it was. Pay your annual fee, keep your foreign income out of reach. And the remittance basis, the rule that you only pay tax on what you bring in, created this whole elaborate industry of structuring your affairs so that your UK life was funded through cleverly routed money that technically never counted as a remittance.
Let's talk about Akshatamurti, because she's the name that turned this from a policy wonk issue into a tabloid firestorm.
April 2022. The Sunday Times runs a story revealing that Murty, who is the wife of Rishi Sunak, then the Chancellor of the Exchequer, soon to be Prime Minister, is claiming non-dom status. She's an Indian citizen. Her father is Narayana Murthy, the billionaire co-founder of Infosys. She holds a roughly 0.9% stake in Infosys worth something like £700 million. And she's not paying UK tax on the dividends from those shares.
Well, her husband is literally the guy raising taxes on everyone else.
That was the gut punch. Sunak had just put national insurance up. The cost of living crisis was biting. And then it emerges that the Chancellor's own household was structured to avoid UK tax on a fortune. The legal estimate was that the arrangement saved her about £20 million in UK tax over several years.
Her defense, or the defense offered on her behalf, was what?
That she's an Indian citizen, and India doesn't allow dual citizenship, so of course her domicile is India, which is legally coherent. Nobody suggested she broke the law. The question was whether it was politically survivable. It wasn't. Within days, she announced she'd pay UK tax on her worldwide income going forward. But the damage was done. The non-dom regime was suddenly front-page news, and neither party could ignore it.
This is where the psychology piece Daniel asked about gets interesting. Because she already had more money than she could spend in 10 lifetimes, why does someone in that position go to the trouble of structuring their affairs to save on tax?
There's a body of behavioral economics research on this. One factor is what psychologists call tax morale, the intrinsic motivation to comply. When people perceive a system as fair, compliance is higher, even when the financial incentive to cheat is large. When wealthy individuals see peers paying low effective rates, tax morale erodes. It becomes normalized. You're not a tax dodger, you're just doing what everyone in your circle does.
It's a social norm among a particular class.
And there's a second layer which is about control and identity. For a certain kind of wealth holder, tax isn't a civic obligation, it's a cost to be managed, like any other. The same mindset that built the fortune treats the tax code as just another system to optimize. If the law allows a structure that reduces your bill, not using it feels like leaving money on the table. It's not about needing the money. It's about not being the sucker who pays more than they have to.
There's a guy, Sir Ronald Cohen, who I think crystallizes this tension. He's this big figure in impact investing, literally wrote books about reducing inequality and making capitalism more inclusive. And he was a non-dom. Born in Egypt, made his fortune in the UK, champion of social impact, and for decades structured his affairs so his global income sat outside the UK tax net.
That's the hypocrisy that makes people's blood boil. The guy who lectures everyone else about social responsibility is personally opted out of the funding mechanism for the social programs he claims to support. And again, everything he did was legal. That's the distinction that Daniel's asking about, legal versus illegal. Tax avoidance is arranging your affairs within the law to minimize tax. Tax evasion is breaking the law, hiding income, falsifying records, lying to HMRC. One gets you a feature in the Financial Times, the other gets you prosecuted.
The boundary can get fuzzy in practice. The line between aggressive avoidance and evasion often comes down to how a specific court interprets a specific structure.
That's where the offshore toolkit comes in. Trusts are the big one. A trust lets you legally separate the ownership of an asset from the benefit of it. You put assets into a trust based in, say, the Cayman Islands or Jersey. The trust owns the assets. You and your family are beneficiaries. Because you don't technically own the assets, they're not yours to be taxed, at least not in the same way. But you still get the income, the use of property, the school fees paid.
Shell companies are the next layer. Ye don't own the London property directly. A British Virgin Islands company owns it. You own the BVI company. When the property is sold, what's being sold is the shares of the offshore company, not the property itself. That can dodge stamp duty, capital gains, inheritance tax. It's all about inserting legal entities between you and the asset.
Carried interest. This is the private equity, one that keeps coming up in U.S. politics too. Private equity fund managers get a share of the profits from their investments, called carried interest. In many jurisdictions, including the UK and the US, this has been taxed as capital gains rather than income. So a fund manager making £50 million in carried interest might pay a capital gains rate of 20% rather than the top income tax rate of 45%.
The justification being that they had capital at risk.
Which is thin, because usually it's other people's capital. The manager puts in a token amount, if anything. The economic reality is that it's compensation for labor, for managing the fund. But the legal form is structured as a return on investment. Form over substance, and form wins.
You've got this whole ecosystem. The non-dom status is the entry point. Then you layer on offshore trusts, shell companies, carried interest treatment, and the result is that someone can live in London, enjoy all the amenities of one of the world's most expensive cities, and pay an effective tax rate that's lower than their cleaners.
The UK was unusually generous in this regard. Most countries tax on a residence basis. If you live here, you pay tax here on your worldwide income. The U.S. taxes citizens and green card holders on worldwide income, regardless of where they live. The UK was this outlier that let you opt out of the system while living inside it.
Why did this become politically untenable now, after 2 centuries?
Multiple things converged. The Murdy story was the spark, but the kindling had been piling up for years. Post-2008, there was a decade of austerity in the UK. Public services were cut, nurses were using food banks, and the political class that imposed those cuts was increasingly seen as drawn from a milieu where non-dom status was common. The Brexit vote in 2016 was partly a revolt against a London-centric elite that seemed to play by different rules.
Then you had the pandemic, where the state spent £400 billion keeping the economy afloat, and suddenly the question of who pays for all this becomes very acute.
The Panama Papers, the Paradise Papers, these massive leaks of offshore financial data, they named names. They showed the mechanics. It wasn't abstract anymore. You could see the specific structures, the specific law firms, the specific politicians and donors involved.
When Labour comes in, abolishing the non-dom regime is one of their flagship pledges.
The reform was announced in the October 2024 budget by Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor. The core change from April 6, 2025, the remittance basis is gone. If you're a UK resident, you're taxed on your worldwide income and gains, same as everyone else. The concept of domicile stops being relevant for tax purposes.
They replaced it with something, though it's not a clean abolition.
Right, they introduced a new regime based on residence, not domicile. For the first 4 years of UK residence, new arrivals can claim a full exemption on foreign income and gains. Bring in whatever you want, no UK tax. After 4 years, you're in the system fully. There's also a temporary repatriation facility that lets existing non-doms bring previously untaxed foreign income into the UK at a reduced rate for a limited window.
It's more like a 4-year holiday than a permanent opt-out.
That's the design. The argument is, if you're a genuine short-term resident, you're here for a posting, a business stint, a few years, you're not penalized. But if you settle, you pay. The line between temporary and permanent is drawn at 4 years, not at some nebulous question of where your father happened to be born.
What about inheritance tax? That was another big piece.
Under the old system, non-doms could avoid UK inheritance tax on foreign assets by holding them through offshore trusts or companies. The new rules shift inheritance tax to a residence-based test. If you've been resident in the UK for 10 years, your worldwide estate is subject to UK inheritance tax, and if you leave, there's a 10-year tail. You remain in the net for a decade after departure.
That's significant. That tail provision closes the old trick of moving to Monaco a year before you die.
And the revenue projections are substantial. The Office for Budget Responsibility estimated the reforms would raise something like £12.5 billion over 5 years. Though there's a big behavioral response question, some non-doms will leave, some already have. The question is how many, and whether the revenue from those who stay and pay outweighs the loss from those who go.
The early signals on that?
Hard to know definitively this early. There were surveys and anecdotal reports in late 2024 and early 2025 of wealth advisors telling clients to consider relocation. Italy, Switzerland, the UAE, have all been positioning themselves as alternatives. Italy has its own flat tax regime for new residents. The UAE has no income tax at all, so the UK isn't operating in a vacuum. It's a competitive market for wealthy residents, and the 4-year holiday is meant to keep the UK attractive without giving away the store permanently.
Let's circle back to the psychology, because I think there's something deeper here that Daniel's question gestures at. The non-dom debate isn't just about revenue, it's about membership. Paying tax is one of the few things that makes you a member of a society in a tangible sense. You contribute to the shared pot. When someone opts out, legally, they're saying, I want the benefits of this place, the security, the infrastructure, the rule of law, the culture, but I don't want to chip in for it. They're residents, but not members. And the non-dom regime formalized that distinction. It created a two-tier citizenship in all but name.
That's the social contract argument, and it's why the Murdy story landed so hard. It wasn't about £20 million in lost revenue. The UK budget is over £1 trillion. £20 million is a rounding error. It was about the symbolism. The Chancellor was asking everyone to pay more while his own household was structured to pay less. That's not a policy failure. That's a legitimacy failure.
Legitimacy is fragile in a way that revenue isn't. You can lose it in a news cycle and spend a generation getting it back.
There's a paper by the economists Lutmer and Singhal on tax morale that makes exactly this point. They looked at data across European countries and found that willingness to pay tax is strongly correlated with perceptions of fairness and trust in government. When people believe the rich are paying their share, compliance holds up. When they don't, it degrades.
What about the counter-argument? The one that says if you tax wealthy foreigners too heavily, they just leave, and then you get nothing. No tax revenue, no spending, no investment.
That's the Laffer curve logic applied to mobile capital and mobile people. And it's not entirely wrong. There is a point at which the rate drives the base away. The question is where that point is. The old non-dom regime was extremely generous by international standards. The new regime is still pretty generous. 4 years tax-free for new arrivals is not nothing. The UK is betting that the combination of London's amenities, the legal system, the time zone, the language, the schools, still makes it worth paying tax after 4 years.
If that bet is wrong,
then revenue projections don't materialize and there's a scramble. But I think the political calculation was that the status quo was no longer viable regardless. The legitimacy cost of maintaining the old system had become higher than the fiscal risk of reforming it. When even conservative MPs were calling for abolition after the Murdy story, the game was up.
Let's talk about the offshore toolkit in a bit more detail, because I think listeners hear offshore trust and shell company, and their eyes glaze over, but the mechanics are worth understanding.
The trust is the workhorse. The basic structure is a settlor puts assets into a trust. Trustees manage those assets, and beneficiaries receive distributions. The magic for tax purposes is that the assets are legally owned by the trustees, not the settlor or the beneficiaries. So, if the trust is established in a low-tax jurisdiction, and the settlor is a non-dom, the trust's income and gains can accumulate outside the UK tax net indefinitely.
The settlor can still access the money through loans.
That's the classic dodge. The trust lends money to the beneficiary. A loan isn't income, and it isn't a remittance of foreign income, or at least it wasn't under the old rules. So you could fund a lavish London lifestyle entirely through offshore loans that were never taxed. The new rules crack down on this by treating certain loans as taxable remittances, but the game of cat and mouse continues.
Shell companies. The Panama Papers showed how pervasive these are. What's the basic mechanic?
You incorporate a company in a jurisdiction with no corporate tax and strong secrecy laws. British Virgin Islands, Panama, Seychelles. That company opens a bank account, buys property, holds investments. You control the company, but on paper, you're just a director or a shareholder. When someone asks who owns the London penthouse, the answer is a BVI shell company. When they ask who owns the shell company, the answer is a trust in the Cook Islands. And when they ask who benefits from the trust, the answer is, well, that's where the trail goes cold.
All of this is legal.
The structures are legal. The opacity is often intentional but not necessarily illegal. The illegality comes in when you lie about it, when you tell HMRC you don't control the company when you do, or you don't declare the income when you're required to. The line between avoidance and evasion is disclosure. If you disclose the structure and it works, it's avoidance. If you hide the structure, it's evasion.
Which is why the push in recent years has been toward transparency, beneficial ownership registries, automatic exchange of information between tax authorities.
The UK introduced a public register of beneficial ownership for companies, and there's a similar register for overseas entities that own UK property. The idea is, make the ownership visible and the tax avoidance opportunities shrink, because HMRC can see who really owns what. It's not perfect. There are still ways to obscure beneficial ownership through complex trust arrangements, but it's a lot harder than it was 20 years ago.
Carried interest. We touched on this, but it's worth unpacking why I keep surviving reform attempts.
Because the private equity industry has extremely effective lobbying. In the UK, the carried interest regime was tweaked rather than abolished. The capital gains rate on carried interest was raised, but it's still below the top income tax rate. The argument the industry makes is that if you tax carried interest as income, private equity firms will relocate to more favorable jurisdictions, and the UK loses an entire industry.
Is that true, or is that a threat?
It's partly true and partly a threat. Some mobility exists. Fund managers can work from anywhere. But the ecosystem that makes London a financial hub, the lawyers, the accountants, the deal flow, the proximity to other funds, isn't portable in a suitcase. There's a first mover problem. If one fund moves, it's at a disadvantage. If they all move, the ecosystem unravels. The industry uses the collective threat while individual funds are reluctant to be the first to go.
The government blinks every time.
The U.S. has the same dynamic. Carried interest has survived multiple reform attempts there, too. It's the cockroach of tax loopholes.
Where does this leave us with the UK reforms? Are they a clean break or a halfway house?
They're a significant shift, but not a revolution. The old system of permanent non-dom status is dead. The new system is more transparent, more residence-based, and harder to game over the long term. But there are still planning opportunities. The four-year holiday is generous. Offshore trusts that were established before the changes get some transitional protection, and the wealthy have very good advisors who are already working on the next generation of structures.
But cat and mouse continues.
It always does. Tax law is a living system. The government writes rules, the advisors find the gaps, the government patches the gaps, the advisors find new ones. The non-dom abolition closed a 200-year-old gap. It's a meaningful moment. But it's not the end of the story.
The deeper question about membership, about whether the wealthiest are fully part of the society they live in, that one doesn't get resolved by a budget measure.
No, it doesn't. And I think that's what Daniel was really getting at. The non-dom regime was a legal expression of a social reality that some people could live in Britain without fully joining Britain. The law has changed. Whether the social reality changes with it is a longer question.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the high medieval period, European scholars widely believed that the apparent mirages seen in the Atacama Desert were caused by the Earth's atmosphere acting as a series of nested crystalline spheres that refracted sunlight like a lens, projecting images of distant objects onto the air itself. They called this the Speculum Eris Theory, and it was taught at the University of Paris for nearly 80 years before being abandoned.
Nested crystalline spheres.
In the Atacama Desert, which medieval Europeans had definitely visited extensively. So the question I'm left with is whether the non-dom abolition actually changes behavior or just changes jurisdictions. If the wealthy leave London for Dubai or Milan, the UK loses not just the tax revenue, but the spending, the investment, the secondary economic activity.
If they stay and pay, the UK gains revenue, but also something less tangible. The sense that everyone is in it together. That's a bet that's going to take a decade to evaluate.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It helps.
See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.